Welcome to the MS Dev Show episode number 36. This week we talk with Josh Holmes to learn what you need to know about the Internet of Things, DRM'd cat litter, and we cry over bad password security. Merry Christmas, Carl. How's it going?
A Merry Christmas to you, Jason. It's going pretty good over here.
So did you get anything good for Christmas? Since we're, you know, playing the show after releasing the show after Christmas.
I don't know yet. I'm not one of those kinds that goes looking for my presents ahead of time. And I haven't had any accidental slip ups from my wife or my kids yet. So,
Okay. So we don't know yet. So next episode, we'll have to talk about that if we got anything cool. And then we have Josh Holmes with us. He's a senior evangelist in the strategic engagement team within DX at Microsoft. Welcome, Josh. How's it going?
Going really well. Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Carl.
Yeah. So looking forward to talking to you because we're going to talk about IoT or Internet of Things in just a bit. But first, let's jump into the news. So, Carl, you had a cool article here on touch and pointer events.
Yes. Somebody put up on GitHub.io. They just went through every browser that they could find. You know, what are the events that get fired and in which order when you touch a screen, when you touch it a second time, and when you leave it. So we're talking about like the JavaScript events that happen in browsers. So like on, I'll just grab one on iOS 7 and Safari, you'll get on the first tap, touch start, touch move, touch end, mouse enter, mouse over, mouse move, mouse down, mouse up and click. All those happen just on that one tap. And it's different on the second tap. And then when you leave, you get the mouse leave and mouse out. And what's really interesting is, you know, a lot of times people just implement what they think is best, like, you know, well, we'll handle all the mouse ones and that'll be good. And then eventually they'll be doing some testing on the tablet and they'll be like, oh, there's these touch events too. And Microsoft uses these pointer events and all that. And when we get looking at these, I mean, he went through a lot of work here. There's a lot of data here. Every browser has something different. There, it's hard to find something common between them all if you're really trying to hit them. So if you want to defensively program, you're in for a lot of work to make sure everything works perfect and flawlessly everywhere.
Yeah, it's a little depressing looking at this at the variation, because what I would end up doing, honestly, if I was developing something using these events, I would I'd probably spit these out to the console and then I would just take a look and say, oh, there's the order. But I think what this shows is don't count on that order, and whatever, you know, your code should support the various orders that are listed here.
And it also makes you realize, you know, who is your audience and what's important to you? Right. Obviously, he did some testing on, you know, some everything he could. And some of it's like Android 2.1. Well, you know, if that's not your audience, you can kind of throw that out and move on.
Yeah. So I noticed something on here. I was actually going to sort of give you a bonus tip here, but it looks like he covered it. There's this, he's talking about this 300 millisecond delay. And I think we might've talked about this on a show a long time ago, because I ran into this whenever you use a touch screen, with certain browsers. So I think Chrome, I can't remember if Chrome or IE, one of the two handles it correctly, but if you touch the screen, it's actually waiting 300 milliseconds for you to see if you're actually doing a scroll. And this was really frustrating because I wrote an AngularJS app, and since it was all running on the client, it was blazing fast, right? Everything was instant. You could actually perceive that 300 millisecond delay. So it has information on here. It's showing like when you actually get this delay. And then I think there's some information in here too on how to turn that off, which is pretty handy.
Yep. Well, so jumping in here for a second, I actually used to be on the Internet Explorer team for a bit.
That's right. That's right. We should have mentioned that in the beginning.
It's one of those, this matrix is terrifying to web developers. But it points out one of the things that you know, as I've been saying for a while, which is that Android is the new IE6.
Yeah.
You know, because we've got, you know, I'm looking at this 2.1, 2.3.7, 4.3, 4.3, and actually 4.3 with Chrome, 4.3 with four or five other browsers,
right?
Including different variations of WebKit. And they all handle all these events in a different order.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, whoa, wait a minute. that just absolutely kills me. But, you know, what's more disturbing to me, to be honest, and this is taking off my Microsoft hat for a moment and just being a web guy, we handle things differently between IE 10 and IE 11. And then IE 10 and IE 11 update one.
Well, the logic that always happens, right, is it's like you look at that and you're like, this is a mess, we should fix it, so we'll do it this way in IE12, and now we have a third way, right?
exactly.
It's so, like, whoops.
Definitely a whoops. But I'm looking at, like, you know, Opera Mini, and it's only supporting the mouse moves. It's not supporting touch events or pointer events.
Yeah.
And pointer events is an amazing standard, and I love pointer events. They actually, if the industry would move to pointer events, it would clear up all this mess.
Right.
But, you know, we can't do that, obviously, because, well.
Yeah, Google's, like, on a crusade to go against it, right?
They were in it for a while. They were with us on the pointer events, and we're actually working to get it supported in Polymer. Mm-hmm. They were making the updates to Core to get the Chrome Core to in order to support them adding pointer events in Polymer, so that you could just program against Polymer and it'd work everywhere. However, for some reason they don't know the politics behind it, but they changed their mind and went back on that decision.
Yeah. So what this page really tells me is I don't want to do front end web development. This looks horrible. Well, I'll stick with the back end where I can define the interface and the other side of it, and I'm, you know, everything is nice.
Well, all of them, it looks like, support mouse.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the lowest common denominator. But what order they support it in is different, and touch is not a mouse. Mm-hmm. The finger is kind of 40-ish pixels wide, mm-hmm. Whereas the mouse is one pixel wide. So and you can have gestures with touch,
yeah.
Whereas with a mouse it's kind of hard. So I mean, they are different things. But if you support mouse at a minimum, you should be okay. But going back to this is news, that is a terrifying page.
Okay, so let's leave it at that and move on. So the next one here, so I saw this one too, Carl, this 10 technical papers every programmer should read, and I've been working on sending these over to my Kindle.
Yeah.
So anything interesting in particular to you in here?
One, I just like to emphasize, you know, I mean, most of us who listen to podcasts such as this one, I mean, we classify ourselves as lifelong learners, and I just saw this as a good set of resources that I probably would never have seen. You know, they're all computer science-y, you know, if not directly computer science. And a lot of them either are really core base stuff. Like there's one that talks about an axiomatic basis for computer programming, where it shows in notation PQR. And he just covers that highly, you know, before the link, that if assertion P is true before program Q, then assertion R will be true on its completion. And if you think about it, I mean, it's very simple, but I mean, it kind of gives you a lot of that math behind what is it that a program does on a high level, you know, given an input to a program, a function, a method, whatever it does inside of it, it will have a result R.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very simple, but at the same time, when you go behind it, you know, a lot of times I like to go back to sometimes what is the math behind what I'm doing? Cause that'll help me either simplify it or refactor it or something. So, you know, I like getting down and dirty into these papers like this, because they help me rethink what I'm doing on a daily basis.
Yeah. This is from 1969, and, you know, there's like pages and pages of paper in here. So that's pretty cool. But what I think is great, I mean, we live in this Twitter, you know, 10 second at most attention span, right? And this kind of stuff is not link baity enough for it to normally pop into what we see. So I think it's good to look at this kind of stuff to be a little bit more well-rounded instead of just getting the seeing all the clickbait. And then one thing I found, as I was trying to find better copies of some of these, and I realized that some of these were like scanned in and then put into a PDF. So I was looking for versions that were a little bit nicer to read. And one thing that I actually came across that I thought was kind of cool is this guy, Swizek Teller. And I don't know when he did this. It looks like, actually, it looks like he finished this year, but like in April of this year. But he had a string of blog posts. We'll include this in the show notes, but it was 52 papers in 52 weeks. So he sort of took this to heart. And every week he read a paper and then he summarized it on his blog, which I thought was pretty neat. Actually, no, now that I look at it, it looks like he just gave up because he got to 20 and I don't see any, that was in April. I don't see anything after that. So definitely not for the faint of heart, but these weren't even necessarily all program related or development related, but they were still, there were interesting, interesting papers out here. Should we move on? Azure Mobile Services Offline Sync SDK.
Now,
and this is now GA. Yep. Go ahead.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, this is now general availability, but, it's something that I forgot that had been out for a while, at least in a preview form. So what this is a lot of people use Azure Mobile Services to, you know, back up their data. So in your code, you'd have, you know, app.mobileservice.get table, and then you'd get all your data back. But what this does is instead of using that get table, you can do get sync table. And it'll, when you're offline, when you don't have that internet access, it'll keep track of all the changes that are happening. And then when it does get access again, it'll sync those behind the scenes. That way you don't have to write all that code, because that code is really hard to write. It's hard to get perfect. So it's nice just to have that just as part of a service. You can just change that in that method call in your app, and that's all you really need to do.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is a problem that's way more complicated than what it seems on the surface, and it also doesn't have to be. I mean, this really kind of hides all the implementation behind the scenes for you and makes it really easy.
Yep, and there's links on this article to the NuGet package for Windows Universal Apps for Xamarin Apps, and it says that iOS and Android SDKs are coming out soon. So this is something, if that's all you need right now, you can grab the code, use it in your production code. It's generally available.
Very cool. Yeah. All you do is instead of get table, yeah, get sync table. What about, does this say anything about conflicts? I'm sure that's in the documentation. I don't see anything on this page. I mean, that's always the big issue, right? Is conflicts. Mm-hmm. Did you read anything about that?
It didn't discuss that in this article. Okay. I'm sure they cover something about that more detailed in the documentation though.
Oh yeah, the first comment: sync data across multiple devices and detect conflicts when the same record is modified by two devices. So it does detect it. I'm wondering if you just have to put in your own custom logic to tell it how to do that. So, okay. Well, anyway, moving on. Oh, and you said that, so this is available in a NuGet. So it's real easy to incorporate in. Cool. And then next. So this one is one that developers will be very interested in, apparently, Carl, DRM'd cat litter.
I mean, we as developers are very familiar with DRM and the downsides of it. And it is, to me, this is just one of those amazing things that people have found a way to put DRM into cat litter. So, you know, what somebody had found is they found this cat litter box that had these plastic beads, and it used this solution to clean the beads whenever their cat used the litter box. And they got sick of, or they got ran out of the cleaning solution one day, and they realized they could just open the bottle and put it in, and it wouldn't use it. And they're like, what the heck? So after doing a little bit of internet searching, they realized there's an RFID chip in there that keeps track of how much that bottle was used and wouldn't let you refill it.
Nice.
And, you know, it just kind of goes to, you know, there's been a lot of controversy over the, you know, like those coffee makers that take K-cups, you know, the new versions of those. If it doesn't detect the right ink on the package, it won't let you brew your cup of coffee. And, you know, to me, this is, you know, products gone wrong. You know, why are you getting sucked into these very tiny ecosystems?
Yeah.
When you don't have to. And, also I brought it out, you know, it's, you know, the Christmas time in the US, you know, we're consuming a lot, we're buying a lot, you know, don't get sucked into these things that, you know, might have this kind of, you know, DRM implemented that we're not aware of.
Yeah. This says $350 on the solution is what it was costing him
a year.
Yeah. So anyway, so what's the solution here?
You know, in this case, they found that somebody had been able to hack it so you can, you know, use your own solution. But I guess be smart shoppers, be thoughtful when you're looking at things. If you're buying something that, you know, takes a consumable or something you have to purchase from time to time, you know, think about, you know, is there a chance that they could be putting a lock on this so I couldn't use my own stuff in the future if I don't want to be locked into their, you know, ecosystem? Mm-hmm. You know, it's,
yeah, so it looks like you can buy these pre-made cartridges now to, you know, sort of aftermarket firmware.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. A lot of, like I just said, you know, a lot of us are used to this in software, but we're not used to thinking of it, you know, like cat litter.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw it with the Keurig machines and that was, I thought that was a little crazy. They're just, it's a money play. Cause all these third party cartridges popped up. So in this case, it looks like, yeah, you can buy this aftermarket firmware. And I don't recall, wasn't there a, I think there's a law, and I don't know, remind me if this is in the US or not. I think there's a law that says that you can do this, right? You can hack your own devices like this. Because I don't think there's anything illegal about this, right? I know that some companies were trying to make it illegal. And I think the court ruled that, hey, you bought it, you can do whatever you want with it.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure, but it does suck. Okay. It is ringing some sort of bell. So I don't know what the status of that is, but.
Okay, no problem. Up next, horrible password security. Did you take a look at this one, Carl?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, since we didn't really talk about security last week, we had mentioned right in the beginning of the show the North Korea attack or the attack on Sony, whoever it was. And I saw this article and just had me shaking my head. This guy, he actually just paid attention a little bit. What was the company here?
Schwab.
Yeah, it was a brokerage account. So this is, you know, this is his retirement account, which arguably has more money in it than any of your other assets, you know, theoretically. And he was talking about this, how they have a 8-character password length limit. So if your password is longer than that, they end up just truncating it, which is pretty crazy. And then he wanted better security. So Schwab offers these tokens that you can get where you get the little, you know, number generator. So you get that thing in the mail. And he was pretty happy with that. He thought it was adding security. Then he decided to try it one day without the token, and it worked just fine. So the token is completely optional, which makes it completely useless. And he had some other things in here, but then I was following up on this and reading about how some other places do this. I don't know if it was Schwab or it was another financial company that they're storing the passwords in plain text, because whenever you reset your password, they're emailing you the password, which of course, then if that email isn't encrypted, every server that email went through has a copy of your password and knows exactly where to go, which is pretty crazy. And then one other thing I wanted to mention on this too was sort of my personal pet peeve that I keep bugging. I love Fidelity, but one thing that really bugs me about their app and a lot of these banking apps, they don't let you save your password. And their response to me was that, we do that for security reasons. But I always argue that if you don't let me save the password, you are promoting easy passwords. And I've been tempted. I have, I don't know, let's say, I think it's like a 20-character random password with Fidelity. I don't even know what it is. I've been tempted to switch that to a really easy password just so that I can use their app. But, you know, I've resisted that temptation, but I guarantee half the people that use Fidelity, they're like, oh, well, I want to make this easier on me. And they're just using a simple password, like their dog's name or their birthday or something like that. So that's been one of my pet peeves. And they say it's for security, but the fact is, you know, I had to use a PIN to unlock my phone. Even if you don't have a PIN, the fact is everybody I know with a smartphone, they get email, they get their email on their phone, right? Which is the master key to everything that you have anyway. So if you have access to my email, you can just go to Fidelity and tell them to reset my password and you get a link to reset the password. So my phone already has full access to Fidelity without, without that password protection. So why don't they save the password for me or let me put a PIN code on it? And I can't remember, there is an app on my phone. I can't remember which banking app it is, but I do have one that lets you save the password and then add an additional PIN on top of it, which I think is the way to go.
Yeah.
Am I the only one that's going to rant here?
No, it's amazing how many places have so many conflicting and poor password rules and validations. Another thing that kind of hit me here was, you know, outside of, you know, what was frustrating from the security standpoints was just, you know, the bad user experience, too. He mentioned that to use that token, he had to like copy it and paste it after his password. which just kind of seems kludgy. I mean, yeah. You know, I've worked on systems in the past where we'll email somebody a special one-time use link that has, you know, a funky token that has to match up. And, you know, with the account that they're trying to log in and a bunch of other things that, you know, it can be done in a secure manner. You can, more and more, you're starting to see like other people do that with unsubscribe links. You know, you just click that link and it knows who you are and it knows that you no longer want that email. You're
exactly.
And, you know, these things can be done in a secure way. They're not that hard. You know, it takes an hour or two of research, an hour or two to implement. And, you know, a little bit of thoughtfulness really helps, you know, keep your user base engaged and thinking highly of you.
And if you're a developer and this stuff scares you, then outsource it. Use something like, you know, I guess I'm plugging this, but Azure Active Directory, you know. So now I was actually, it was just kind of top of mind. I was integrating it with a website. I made it so it's just a few lines of code to integrate it. And you basically end up, the library handles the, you know, the trust. It handles seeing when a user is unauthenticated. It sends it over to a site that's capable of authenticating you, one that is already handling a bajillion authentications and has already been hardened and secured, and then sends that back. And, you know, so you don't even need any code. I mean, it's pretty tough to screw it up. So,
yeah, well, that's not good enough for some companies.
Right.
My favorite horror story around security was there was an admin, security admin in this company I worked for in Ann Arbor. Fortunately, I was just a contractor there.
Yeah.
But they had 60 some odd employees. They used Active Directory for their authentication and all that kind of stuff. However, this guy did not trust random password generators. They weren't random enough.
Nice.
And so,
well, because they're pseudo random.
Right. So every month, because he had a 30-day password change cycle.
Yeah.
Because that's useful. And he went through and handmade up 60 some odd passwords. Mm-hmm. They were all 20-ish characters, random capitalization and letters, and then went around and gave everybody their password.
Nice.
So what would you do if somebody handed you a random string of characters that was 20 some odd, you know, characters long that you had to memorize and type in every day?
Well, I would change it a second later.
Well, he'd lock that down. You couldn't do that.
Nice. Well, then you're going to put it on a sticky note, of course.
Yes, you do.
Yep.
And where do you put the sticky note?
Yeah, right on your monitor.
Right on your monitor. The other fun one was he did the same thing for all the servers. And of course, you know, the servers, you know, I had access to five of them. So, I mean, I'm not going to remember 100 some odd random characters.
Right.
So immediately all those got written down on a sticky note and taped to the side of the server.
Yeah. Well, that did happen in that Sony hack too. I mean, there were files called passwords.txt and it had all the passwords in there. And then yep. I had some fun arguments with Sarbanes-Oxley auditors, and they came in and they were saying that, hey, you have to, you know, similar to what you said, you have to change your passwords, you know, every 60 days. And we were trying to get it so that link was longer and longer. And you know, I was trying to make the argument. It's like, listen, the more difficult you make this for users and the more complexity you add. And as you add, this complexity, they're going to write it down. And it's going to be on their monitor. So I said, why not let them come up with good random passwords on their own, and you know, let them keep it for a good period of time, because you're not going to be able to really do anything with it in a brute force attack anyway. And then the other thing was, you know, this notion that you have these complexity requirements, and basically Sarbanes-Oxley, they dictated the exact complexity it had to have. And it was always, oh, it has to be, you know, like 8 characters and a number and a, you know, whatever. Right. And it basically defined what every password looked like. So your attack vector for, you know, guessing passwords was so small because right. You knew pretty much everybody was picking. It was like dictionary word plus 1 to 3 digit numbers plus, you know, exclamation or question mark, or you change the letters to 0, you know, get clever there, and E's to 3's and things like that. So it just makes it so that it's so easy to, you know, guess these passwords. It's just ridiculous. Okay. Should we move on? Okay, sounds good. So let's talk to Josh about something that we sort of talked about in the past. We talked to Tim Park regarding Nitrogen at one point, which was a pretty cool framework for IoT. And I know we've had, I think, 10 different episodes where we've mentioned, hey, we should do an IoT episode, Internet of Things episode. And finally, we're getting around to it. And, you know, I sort of, thought in, you know, search my brain for, you know, who would be a good, well-rounded person to do this. And I know, Josh, you have quite a bit of experience in this space, because you've been working with a lot of different people at Microsoft. You've been working with, you know, startups and companies like that. So do you want to give us a little bit of your background?
Sure. So it's a long and varied background. How far back do we want to go? You know, I used to run landscaping crews and do all kinds of other weird things. Like, I was a bouncer for a while. I provided personal security for Salt and Pepper.
Oh, really?
That's cool. For a brief time back in the 91, same year that they were really, really hot.
Yeah.
In all essences of the word. But I'm assuming that's not the background you're talking about.
No, unless okay. There was sort of an IoT angle.
not way back then.
No, that's fine.
So I've been a web guy for a very long time. I mean, okay. My first consulting back in the day was early to mid 90s, was all ASP Classic. I've got some fun horror stories I can tell from those days. But, you know, I've always been fascinated by how we have this incredible intelligence, you know, sometimes just in our pocket. I mean, it was the day when I realized that my phone that I had in my pocket, had more computing power than the, rockets landed on the moon.
Right.
And, you know, and then, you know, and that was late 90s, mm-hmm. You know, so things have come along so much further since then. And so things around us are becoming much, much more intelligent and much more engaged. And it's a fascinating thing to me to watch that happen, and really exciting to be part of that. As I mentioned earlier, I was part of the Internet Explorer team for a while. And, you know, while that was great in helping connect users to the Internet, what's really exciting to me is connecting things to the Internet and starting to apply intelligence to it.
Right.
So I've been doing that for about a year now. I've been fairly heavily embedded in Microsoft's all-up Internet of Things strategy. Mm-hmm. When you were talking to Tim about Nitrogen, I'm one of the core members on the Nitrogen team. I've been working very closely with the Event Hubs team. I've mm-hmm. been working very closely with, you know, the Windows on Devices team. Et cetera, et cetera, here at Microsoft, and helping figure out what our strategy is and our go-to-market is.
Okay.
So when somebody says Internet of Things, what does that imply? Because for a lot of people, that's a buzzword. And for a few other people, you know, they may have a very shallow definition of what that is, whether it's, an individual device that hooks up to the Internet or something, or maybe even more industrial version of what that means. So when that's called out, what, from your point of view and the people that you've worked with, what does that imply?
So when the people that are talking about Internet of Things, on the Internet, a lot of them, where they think, I've hooked up my coffee pot to my iPhone. Mm-hmm. That's cute. It's cute. It's not, you know, and I mean, I guess some people think
that's going to change the world, man.
Absolutely, man. Well, and sadly, they're getting VC money for that. Hmm. The what kills me about that, though, is that, you know, I think that's cute. The Internet of Things, though, is not just being able to connect one thing to one other thing. The Internet of Things is really having things that are all working in concert together as a system. And so what's much more interesting to me is, well, my phone knows where I'm at. That's great. Mm-hmm. And my Fitbit knows how many steps I'm taking, and so on and so forth. So as I'm running around and I'm, you know, out on my bike, and I have just biked, you know, 10 miles through the woods, you know, mountain biking, and that's being tracked by my phone, by my Fitbit, by, you know, other devices around me and on my phone. It's checking to see how many calories I'm burning. And so my fridge is now starting to pull together recipes that are going to help me do my calorie replenishing. and my carb replenishing. And, you know, when I get home, all that's ready to go for me to start, you know, chopping up the right vegetables. And there's the recipes right there. Mm-hmm. You know, that's systems working together. Similarly, you know, you start looking at any large scale factory. And I know, Jason, you've done a lot in manufacturing. Mm-hmm. You actually have a framework that you've written, the manufacturing framework for Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. Is that available anywhere publicly?
Yeah, it's on GitHub.
Okay. And where on GitHub is that?
We can include a link in the show notes. You want me to send it to you?
I don't know. I know where it's at. I was just, you know, let's just make sure we get it in the show notes.
Yep. It's github.com/ytechie. And then under the repositories, you can see there's a whole bunch of repositories that have the manufacturing prefix.
Yep. Cool. And so, you know, when you start thinking about a large scale factory, the just in time inventory process that, the lean manufacturing, mm-hmm. That a lot of the industry is moving to, it becomes incredibly important for everything to be working in concert.
Oh, yeah.
And so, ranging from on the system, you know, on the conveyor belt, you know, how fast are the items moving? What is the, you know, the contents of the bins that are supplying this particular, wow, my brain just went completely
dry. Production line.
Thank you.
Yep.
All the bins that are supplying this particular production line. What is the trigger point for ordering new stuff? Mm-hmm. Does a human have to be involved in that? And then, you know, well, now that we know that we need XYZ plastic pellets, let's go order that truck full of plastic pellets to come in. But where's the truck? How long is it going to get here? What kind of traffic is between here and there? There's so much potential to make everything so much more streamlined and to have the correct redundancies built in. I mean, lean manufacturing, if all of a sudden one of the trucks is involved in a traffic accident, we should know that,
yep.
You know, or if it's delayed in traffic and, you know, not even in the accident itself, but just delayed in traffic, we should be able to go get the, you know, plastic pellets that we need from a different source.
Mm-hmm.
From quality control to predictive maintenance to, you know, supply chain management, in the enterprise and in manufacturing, it's incredibly cool of space. But also at home, and this is where it's getting a lot of hype and a lot of press, is, you know, I think houses are becoming a lot smarter. Long-winded answer, but, you know, when people talk about, let's connect, you know, my iPhone to my, you know, phone or my coffee pot or, you know, my
toaster
security system or toaster or whatever it is. Again, that's cute and it can be useful.
Yeah.
But when I'm thinking of Internet of Things, I'm thinking of a system of things that are all working in concert together and, you know, really making the entire ecosystem and our surroundings more intelligent, more reactive to us. And that's really cool.
Yeah.
So as an example, next week, I'm going to be at CodeMash. Mm-hmm. And CodeMash, great conference. I know you guys have had
Clark Sell
on who did.
And then also Jeff Blankenberg.
Yep. And so Jeff has been integral to CodeMash since the beginning. Mm-hmm. Actually, a trivia fact, Drew Robbins and myself founded CodeMash way back in the day.
Okay, cool.
And then we handed it over to Jim Holmes, who did a much better job running it than I ever would have. amazing, amazing guy. If you ever get a chance to go sit down and have a beer with him, you'll get smarter.
Is he related to you?
No
okay.
relation.
Okay, I just making sure.
I mean, we trace back to tangent. We trace back to his family came in from Kentucky at one point in time.
Okay.
And my family came down from Kentucky to Arkansas.
Okay.
And so the Holmes side of my family has been sharecroppers in Arkansas for, you know, close to 200 years. Mm-hmm. But we think that at some point we were probably related back in Kentucky, but
that's pretty cool.
200 plus years ago.
So, yeah.
You know, however many generations.
But anyway, so getting back to what you're talking about before, I think those are amazing scenarios. So the, you know, you were talking about the sort of the home scenario and I kind of feel the same way. I think there's some sort of breakthrough things. I mean, people have talked about all these devices working together in your home and I think it will, change people's lives to a certain extent. And just because there are so many people on the planet, obviously it's the opportunities there are huge in aggregate. But whenever we look at manufacturing, I think we're at such an, you know, it's really in its infancy as far as the type of collaboration of devices that you were talking about. And that's where I get really excited, because there's these companies, if there is a return, they are willing to invest. So that's good. There's an opportunity for money there. And, as time goes on, I think that the return on investment, the ROI, is going to keep getting better and better as these things get smarter. And it's going to be required for these companies to compete, because even if they get, dragged in kicking and screaming, their competition is going to be doing it and they're going to be more profitable. So it's something I don't think these companies are going to be able to avoid, for too much longer. They tend to move kind of slow, so they still have a little bit of time. But man, we keep seeing it more and more. One thing I just want to broaden what this whole thing looks like, and then we'll kind of come back in. But one thing I was curious about is, how does the cloud fit into this whole thing?
So absolutely. Let me finish up my thought from earlier.
Real quick. Hey, go ahead.
So at CodeMash, I'm running a workshop, a lab, and me and Brent Steinman are going to be doing a lab where the central thing is that when you walk into the room, we have motion sensors. Mm-hmm. And the motion sensors are going to say, hey, there's somebody here. Yeah. Great. And it's going to start firing notifications all over and saying, well, they're over here now. They're over here now. And so the lab is, everybody builds other devices that fit into that scenario as a connected room.
Okay.
And so the lights start coming on. I've got Bluetooth lights. We've got, other lights that we can wire in directly into the Arduino UNs and whatnot. We've got speakers, that we can, connect to via Bluetooth as well. We've got all kinds of little devices and, servos to open blinds and, do locks and pressure sensors and, so we're going to build a smart room in a day. Mm-hmm. as this lab at CodeMash. You asked about the cloud.
Yeah.
The cloud is incredibly important to the Internet of Things, because even though these devices are becoming an incredible amount more intelligent, more powerful, the fact of the matter is that they need to be able to connect to somewhere for data analysis, for all kinds of different synchronization and coordination between all the different devices. I mean, peer-to-peer is fantastic, and I love the resilience that you get from a peer-to-peer network.
Right.
However, a peer-to-peer network doesn't do big data analysis.
Right.
We've got in the cloud, generically, the capability for tremendous amounts of processing. And that becomes very exciting when you start talking about machine learning. Mm-hmm. And so, coming back to the manufacturing scenario that we were talking about earlier, we as humans have an idea of how much time it's going to take for pellets to get in and what the right cutoff level is to order new pellets. But what if we start looking at the actualities of it and we allow machines to aggregate hundreds of thousands of orders and figure out exactly how many seconds it's going to take and exactly what the right cutoff is to make things as lean as possible? Mm-hmm. And how do we do that intelligently? Well, machine learning is going to be able to get us there.
How far away are we from, seeing devices that, act together in tandem in unison like that?
So what you're talking about there is what they call mesh technologies, mm-hmm. Where the devices, instead of talking through a central server, they're actually talking directly to each other. And so mesh is very exciting, and I think that there's a strong future for mesh. In fact, one of our coworkers, a guy named Jeroen, is working on a project called Tali. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember the
T-H-A-L-I.
Yes, thaliproject.org. And Tali is an open source platform for building mesh networks and mesh devices. Very cool. Lots of great stuff. The where we are at the moment is that it's still in its kind of in its infancy.
Right.
I mean, we have the ability to program devices to talk directly to each other, and we have the ability to do mesh networks. But A, you know, it's not out of the box, and B, people are not using it to its fullest. Where I see it being really, really interesting and really useful is in scenarios where the show must go on. You know, so if you think about a hospital and all the devices that are in the room are, you know, talking back to a central server, what happens if that central server goes down? We still need to keep the patient alive.
Right. That's probably a good idea.
Maybe. You know, same kind of a thing, you know, manufacturing floor. You know, if the internet connection goes down, we still need the production line to work.
Oh, yeah. Especially, and, I mean, that could be, you know, $1 million a minute that they're producing.
Absolutely. I mean, it's staggering some of the numbers that are coming out of some of these manufacturing plants.
Right.
And as Jason said, it's literally millions of dollars a minute. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you know, the margin is 2% on that.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, what that means is that they're losing $980,000 a minute. And, you know, and their profit would have been $20,000
or something. Right. That's a good point.
Yeah. Anyways, the, but in those scenarios, the mesh networks are, incredibly important. The trick though is that the devices themselves have to be powerful enough in order to actually do some computing, mm-hmm. and to actually do do some real work. The great news is that is happening. If you look at the size of the chips that are out there now compared to what they used to be, it's phenomenal. Moore's Law is still in effect. You know, my device that I've been playing with quite a bit recently is the Arduino Yune. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys have seen the Arduino Yune, but it has a what they call an Amtel chip, which is a small real-time processing chip. That's what's on most of the Arduinos. Now, those devices, those little chips, are not smart enough, not bright enough to do a lot of the things that we kind of need, such as security. Mm-hmm. I've gotten Polar SSL running on a Arduino Due.
Okay.
However, it took over a third of the RAM. I mean, it was a tremendous percentage.
Wow.
of the RAM on the device just to load that library. Mm-hmm. And then my app took the rest of it, and right. It had no RAM left over for actual processing.
Mm-hmm.
Shit. But what the Yune has got, in addition to the little Amtel chip to do real-time kind of work, it also has a little bitty, and it's about 2 inches by 1 inch wide and tall, and then its depth is probably, I don't know,
millimeter?
About a millimeter, yeah. 16th of an inch or so. I mean, it's teensy.
Yeah.
It's a Linux system on a chip. There are also Windows systems on a chip. Those are the predominant, you know, kind of system on a chip, mm-hmm. Operating systems. But, you know, in that little bitty chip, it's got Wi-Fi. It's got some flash memory. It's got the processor itself, which is a typically low processing power, but sufficient for what we need for a single purpose device. You wouldn't put a server on there.
Right, right. Well, that's however, the thing. I mean, your desktop computer is extremely powerful because they have to be so general purpose. So I think,
yes.
I think it was, you know, you mentioned it real quick, but the fact that these things are sort of single purpose, yes. means that they just don't need a lot of compute power. They only do exactly what they need. And you don't have, you know, this complicated scheduler running that has to shuffle 50 different, actually on my computer right now, even though I'm not doing anything, there's probably 10,000 things going on right now simultaneously, and they all have to be managed.
Yep. And these devices don't have that complexity. Mm-hmm. You know, in order for a mesh network to be listening, to be working, it needs to be able to do some type of active processing and passive listening for incoming events.
Right.
And, you know, so because we can't do long polling like we do to servers, we actually need to be able to push direct connections into the device. Mm-hmm. And it needs to have fairly sophisticated networking abilities so that it can do, you know, kind of Wi-Fi direct, you know, from device to device to device to device.
Right.
And, you know, once we have those things in place, it's pretty magical what you can get done.
Yeah.
The key is, though, each device has to be fairly self-sufficient, but single purpose, you know, and doing one small bit. And it knows how to make decisions for itself. Once you have that, mesh is a great way to go. But you also still need kind of the centralized processing power for that big data analytics to be able mm-hmm. to look, you know, across not one production line, but across a dozen production lines or, you know, a dozen factories or, you know, an entire company.
Yeah. And I would think really, even from an orchestration perspective. So you have these devices like, hey, I can open and close this valve. And I know that this other device is going to tell me like when this product goes by, but somebody's got to tell us, you know, how to, you know, at least initially how we should work together. Like I should watch this valve and when, or I should watch when a product goes by and I should open this valve and then they could work independently. But it, yeah, I mean, I hadn't really thought about this before, but you need somebody to just sort of give that initial, you know, configuration push or the original instruction set.
Well, and beyond just the original instruction set, there's also, you know, right now I need a whole bunch of, front windows for a car. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to produce a whole bunch of them really quickly. Well, actually, there was a slowdown in this other part, and I don't need these front windows stacking up. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to slow down this production line to let everybody else catch up. You know, that's centralized decision making versus local mesh networking.
Yeah. So it's sort of a mesh of devices, but I would almost think like they're organized in sort of a tree structure where you have, you know, sort of supervisor nodes that are always one level above another set of nodes.
Yeah, I think that's the direction that we're going to end up going with the IoT frameworks, especially in larger companies and in manufacturing. You know, at home, you know, the problem that we're going to have at homes is that, you know, there's 1,001 different protocols out there, and everybody's still licking the cookie and saying, "Hey, I want to be king of the mountain."
Yep.
And you know, and so there's not a centralized way to do.
I've never heard that licking the cookie. It took me a minute. That's awesome. I do that with my kids. So you lick the cookie. Yeah. And then it's yours. Okay. I get it. That is awesome. I have not heard that one. That's cool. Sorry. That amused
me. It's no problem. There's a lot of cookie licking going on in the IoT space, especially in the homes.
Yeah.
You know, in the homes, it's you know, there's 1,001 protocols and 1,001 different companies. And when you actually get down to it, they all do exactly the same thing, mm-hmm. only similar to the kitty litter. They have decided to DRM it all so that they can be, you know, king of the mountain.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And I would say some of them are closed ecosystems. Some are open, but mm-hmm. but everybody wants to own it, of course.
Right, exactly. And so since everybody wants to own it, what happens is more and more and more and more fragmentation. I think that that's going to be an interesting space to watch mm-hmm. from a because, I mean, they're way behind where the manufacturing world is. I mean, the manufacturing world, you know, at one point in time was this fragmented or more so, and in some ways still is, but mm-hmm. you know, there are at least a handful of financially driven decisions mm-hmm. that have, you know, if you want to sell into XYZ company, you have to support OPC.
Yep.
You know, or you have to support, you know, some other
BACnet or something like that.
Exactly. And so as a result of some financially backed pressure, it has force some standards in the manufacturing space in particular. But, you know, if you look at the home, part of the problem is that we've got an incredibly, and I'm, you know, I apologize if this sounds, you know, abrasive or whatever, we've got an incredibly unintelligent society buying these devices. I mean, think about the...
I would say, let's say uninformed.
Uninformed. Uninformed is a much better word. Yes. Uninformed is a much better word. Naive.
Yeah.
Even.
Yeah.
Naive is probably the better word.
Yeah.
Because naive is, I want to trust that all this is going to work.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's not going to.
Right.
Until I buy that cat litter and realize it's $345 a damn bottle. Dadgummit. And you know, and that they've built in, you know, systems to lock it down and make sure I can't use anything else. Mm-hmm. Well, shoot. And so, you know, we're getting into that scenario right now, or we are in that scenario with home automation. You know, there's 1,001 different standards, and all of the big companies that could conceivably play in this space are trying to play in this space. I mean, you know, Best Buy, Lowe's, Comcast for some reason, Rogers in Canada. Yep. You know, and then obviously Google with the Nest and so on. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's also other companies that are trying to produce standards. Qualcomm is you know, doing a pretty good job pushing a standard called AllJoin. Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about the mesh network, AllJoin is a kind of a form of that. It's peer-to-peer within the same network, you know, within the same home typically. And so if you go buy a new smart LG TV, all the smart LG TVs are all AllJoin enabled, meaning that, you know, they can talk to any speakers that are AllJoin enabled, or, you know, there are coffee pots, there are lights, the LIFX lights, the light bulbs are going to be AllJoin enabled. You know, there's quite a few devices. And Qualcomm is, as you know, they produce this as their own way of doing communication, and then they have they're trying very hard to make this a kind of industry standard, and have put together an alliance with. They started with the Linux Foundation. Mm-hmm. It's called the All Seen Alliance, and the All Seen Alliance now is the chief cat herders on the AllJoin specification and protocols. And so what this allows you to do is, there's a set of what they call, buses that are running, and the bus, you know, all the devices that are AllJoin enabled, they connect to the bus, mm-hmm. and go, you know, hey, you know, I support this type of an interface. Right. So I support a light interface, or I support a TV interface, or I support a dimmable light, which is different from a light.
Right.
Or, you know, here are my capabilities. And so there's this discovery mode that you can, you know, that they all broadcast. And then other devices that want to control lights can say, hey, who are the lights on the system?
Right.
And so now I can connect to those lights, and I can start controlling those lights. And so your TV could say, what are the lights in this room? And I'm going to dim them when I start a movie. Yeah. You know, and so, you know, or, you know, you could have a centralized controller that is talking to all of them over AllJoin. But we've got a common protocol, a common way to discover the devices. New devices that come onto the network, you know, the onboarding process is very simple, and then you know, centralized ways to control them. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited about AllJoin.
Yeah, just having a standard there is really exciting to me, because yeah, device onboarding has traditionally been a pain. I mean, I have three of these thermostats, these radio thermostats, and I didn't realize the Wi-Fi modules weren't installed. But you know, taking that into account, it took me, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours to get these things set up. Most of that was because the modules weren't actually in them. Yep. But man, what a pain. And really, I should have been able to, you know, connect to those through some kind of generic protocol initially, and using AllJoin, discover them, and then automatically configure those. And it should have been an almost completely automatic process, but it was such a hassle. So that it's good to think that problem should get solved here at some point.
Absolutely. No, my dream is that we just turn on a new device and bam, it starts showing up in the system. Mm-hmm. And the system is smart enough to accept it as one of its own and start playing nicely with it.
Right.
So AllJoin, though, Microsoft All Up has taken a big bet on AllJoin. Mm-hmm. So there was a blog post back in November that you know, talked about how we've actually built in a AllJoin router into Windows 10.
Yep.
So the bus that I was talking about, if you have a Windows 10 machine in your home, you already have a all joined bus running in your house, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
And my team, there's a guy named Ivan Judson. You can find him on GitHub at irjudson, J-U-D-S-O-N. He has been working on a set of Cordova plugins for AllJoin. And so what that means is that we'll be able to write cross-platform apps, truly cross-platform apps, with a AllJoin plugin for obviously Windows Phone 8.1 mm-hmm. And later, but also iPhone and Android, and be able to control AllJoin devices from your phone, from your cross-platform apps.
Right.
And you know, and he's running the thin client, which doesn't have a bus because we don't need a bus.
Right.
It's a phone.
Yeah, we're assuming one already exists. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. Go ahead, Carl.
I was going to say, you know, you talked a lot about AllJoin. Are there any kind of big competitors to that? And, you know, if so, or if not, you know, is AllJoin kind of, you know, something that could be the future of IoT in the household?
So there are absolutely competitors, you know, going back to the cookie licking. There's a lot of companies that are trying to lick the cookie here and trying to set the standard because they have this idea that if they set the standard, they control it. Mm-hmm. And so Google is probably has the largest competitor, which would be Thread. There's other larger ones like iControl. iControl is believe it or not, it's not Apple. It's iControl is a networker devices that are all what do you call iControl certified, and they actually white label to a number of different companies. So when you look at Comcast, they're actually not doing their own development of IoT devices. They're actually white labeling from iControl.
Okay.
And there's a number of companies that produce iControl devices. They pay extraordinarily large licensing fees to iControl in order to do that. But you know, the biggest open protocols at the moment would be Thread and AllJoin. I know there are others out there, but those are the two biggest. And then there's a number of proprietary ones as well.
Okay, cool. So going back to the devices that we were talking about, I know you mentioned a couple, but what are the most interesting devices to you right now?
Well, so it depends on what space you're talking about. So,
well, I guess I was thinking just personally to you. Is there anything that you're particularly excited about? I know the the Yun, I think, is the one that you were really excited about.
The Arduino Yun. Yep. I'm really excited about the Arduino Yun because it's an incredibly powerful little bitty device for $70.
Right.
But I also, I like the whole Arduino ecosystem because it's so open and so friendly and easily accessible. Arduino.cc, mm-hmm. and if you go look at their product page, you know, they have an incredible number of different little Arduino devices. There's probably 20 some odd different devices ranging from, you know, the Arduino Yun, which has got embedded Linux on it, but most of them are much smaller devices. I like the little bitty Arduino Micro, which is, you know, it's smaller than a quarter, mm-hmm. and you can, it's got all the little pinouts that you can solder to, and you can actually put that in a actual device that you're going to be putting out in a hardened scenario. What I love about the Arduino ecosystem is that I can start as a maker, and it's very accessible to me, and I can get into that ecosystem very quickly and very easily. But it grows with me. I can start. Once I get up to the Yun, that little system on a chip, the little Linux system on a chip, is actually produced by a company called Dog Hunter, and Dog Hunter. They sell the system on a chip there, and I can get it with Wi-Fi, the Linux system on a chip, some amount of memory, some amount of flash and ROM, and all the correct pinouts for me to just drop it onto a larger device that I want. And I can have those pinouts custom made for me for about $12 per chip when I'm ordering in quantities of 5,000 or more.
Nice.
That's awesome. You know, because now all of a sudden I can build a fairly intelligent system, you know, with you know, Linux and hopefully soon Windows behind it for $12 a chip.
Yeah.
Okay. My whole bill of materials for a new device can be less than $20.
Yeah.
And including some sensors. And I mean, I'm paying retail. I'm paying 89 cents for light sensors. Mm-hmm. Retail.
Yeah.
If I'm ordering those in bulk, I can get those down to, you know, easily, you know, pennies.
Yeah. So, and that's what's important. I mean, cost is one of the biggest considerations here, right? I'm not going to fill my house with 100 sensors if each sensor is $100. It's just not going to happen.
No. Absolutely not. Quantity is absolutely one of the you know, drivers of cost. You know, so you think about the Nokia 520. Mm-hmm. Have you guys seen the Nokia 520, the Lumia 520? It's a great little phone.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a it's got a screen. It's got Wi-Fi. It's got and then with Wi-Fi, it's got BG and N. It's got Bluetooth. It's got you know, a whole bunch of different sensors. It's got accelerometers. It's got a compass. It's got that big, you know, the nice touch screen. It's got, you know, slots for SD cards and a whole bunch of other stuff. And I can go buy that again retail, no contract, $50. Mm-hmm. And, you know, reading Microsoft's financial report, we're not losing money on that device.
Right.
You know, that we're making those devices for less than $50.
Yeah, I actually picked up some of the 635s. I think you got one too, Carl.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, and that's we got those for $40. And they,
right, I missed that sale.
Yeah, and they make the 520 look old by comparison. I mean, it's quad core and SD card reader and, you know, all the features you mentioned earlier, even sensor core. I mean, yep. So it's getting, you know, high resolution motion data 24/7. Just amazing. Absolutely. what is you know, the technology into there, and it just shows what you can build at scale.
Absolutely. But even not at scale, I mean, you know, when you think scale, you know, if you're talking about, you know, 5,000 units, that's decent scale, and you start getting some pretty good reductions in price at that point in time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's very exciting to me. But, you know, I've also got Raspberry Pis. I've also got the Lenovo One, which is actually uses the same chipset as what's in the Yun there. I've got a tremendous number of different Arduinos. I've got a bunch of little Bluetooth beacons. Beacon technology is going to be very cool here in the next handful of years. Mm-hmm. As we get smarter about where our devices are and how we're interacting with them. I was trying to think through. I mean, I've got a shedload of little devices.
Yeah, I know. Every time I see you, you know, you have like a stack of new devices. So.
Absolutely.
That space, it's so cool. It's all the stuff going on. I in particular, I like the Raspberry Pi because I like to show people, hey, this is, you know, you can get this thing for as little as, I think, $25. And this is an entire computer. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's a computer. And I, you know, I set mine up in 10 minutes. I put Raspbian on it. And then I was SSHing into it. And, you know, I can run it headless, but I can hook it up to a screen, and it's amazingly powerful for how inexpensive it is.
It absolutely is. And I've got four of those that are all, I don't take them with me because they're normally working. I've got one doing an air quality sensor. One of them is controlling a stereo. One of them is controlling blinds. And the other one my son took off with, and I don't know where he went with it.
Yeah. So one more thing that we haven't talked about is the S word. You know what I'm talking about? Security.
Yes.
So what do you want to say on security? Because I know there's, you know, there's obviously security concerns and honestly, a lot of there's some people that start the discussion with security, fortunately, and a lot of people that sort of finish it. And, to be honest right now, you know, when I talk about these things, security is always at the end. And, you know, I'm asking this question at the end. Doesn't mean it's not important, though. So what do you have to say about security?
No, security is I'm a security nut, mm-hmm. to a degree, which is one of the reasons why the jackass that was doing the passwords was so annoying to me. But security is kind of a given for me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those, you know, I just assume that it's going to be there right. because I'm going to build it in from the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's actually, you know, when you're talking about devices, you know, let's just start in the home for a moment. There was a movie, and I'm trying to remember the name of it. There was a movie, Jason Alexander was in it. And it was a industrial espionage, movie where Jason Alexander was the head of one company, and there was another company. I can't remember the name of the guy.
Oh, is this from a long time ago?
It's a while back.
Yeah,
but if you start thinking about the all the things that they were doing in there, mm-hmm. okay, like they were monitoring the number of cars in a parking lot at a building, and they were, you know, watching the trash pickups. They weren't looking at the trash itself. They were looking at the number of pickups. Mm-hmm. And they were looking, I mean, there were so many things that they were looking at there. And, you know, as a guy doing threat modeling, all of a sudden it becomes a little scary as to what information people can pull, especially when you're talking about my house.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you think about it, if you can tap into my, you know, just figuring out how much electric current I'm pulling. You can tell when I go to bed.
Right.
You can tell when I'm not at home.
Actually, I got a good example for this one. I saw this recently. I think it's out on YouTube. We'll see if we can dig it up. But there's all these unsecured IP cameras on the internet. And some of yes. them, or I should say many of them, have microphones. And some of them right. actually have a speaker as well. And I believe I have one, actually. It was this little free one I got at CES. And so there's some videos on YouTube. And there's one in particular that's hilarious. Because it's this this couple, they're sitting there watching, you know, some TV show, and the camera is pointed right at them, and then he starts playing music through it. And every time the guy gets up to sort of figure out what it is, he turns it off. And then right. he's like, you know, the guy finally is yelling out, he's like, "How are you doing this? Who's doing this?" And the guy's right. like, "Well, your camera is not secure." And he starts having a conversation with the guy, and it's scary. Yep. I mean, I have a couple cameras on my house. And, you know, I want to make sure that those are secure. They're not, you know, they're not, it's not like I have it like, you know, pointed in my bedroom or in the bathroom or anything like that. But, you know, that being said, right. I want to make sure that there's, you know, if I wanted to do that, I want to make sure there's good security for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, I mean, the cameras and that kind of stuff are the very obvious security holes attack surfaces. And if you start thinking about the rest of the possible sensors that are in the house, you know, you've got cameras, you've got smoke detectors, you've got carbon dioxide detectors, you've got, speakers can be turned into microphones. Mm-hmm. You've got all kinds of different possible attack surfaces. And there was a guy that was in the accelerator that I was working with here in Redmond through Microsoft Ventures. Mm-hmm. And the guy's company is called Red Balloon Security. And Ang, the CEO, he became internet famous back in 2011 when he emailed himself a resume on stage at Columbia University.
Yeah.
And he printed the resume. The act of printing the resume, the postscript in the document, rewrote the firmware on the printer, got its heads moving back and forth so fast that it set itself on fire.
Yeah.
Nice. Which is kind of spectacular.
Yeah. 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 It's pretty, now, I've heard of there's a couple different, ways that's happened before. It's usually pretty difficult, but yeah, that's scary.
Absolutely. Well, so that one is fairly obvious as in, you know, it happened and bam, there was an immediate consequence. And then, you know, lots of great showmanship of the printer set on fire. Awesome. Mm-hmm. However, the one that's more insidious, that's a little more terrifying to me, is that he also proved out that what he could do is he used the printer as an access point to the network.
Okay.
And so the print rewrote the firmware on the printer. Okay. So he knows how to do that.
Yep.
However, from there, he was able to branch and start attacking Cisco IP phones.
Right.
And turn them into microphones.
Well, yeah, because now he's in the network. Yeah.
Now he's on the network. And he's got a port in. So the printer can now call out and get new instructions. Whoops.
Yeah.
you know, so now his company, He's not just a black hat hacker. He is a white hat hacker. And his company, what they do is they write firmware level security software, mm-hmm. firmware level virus scanning.
Okay.
And so you basically he lifts your firmware, writes his firmware underneath it, puts yours back, and he watches all the I/O ports and watches for suspicious activity and that kind of stuff. It's kind of terrifying what is possible there.
Yeah. That always seems like kind of a hack too. I mean, then you're counting on that virus protection to catch it. I mean, like at my home computer, like I would never put my computer on the internet as an example and then, count on the virus protection. Like there has to be a whole bunch of, it has to be secure from the start, blocking the right traffic and things like that.
Yep. No, it's a belt suspenders and two hands to hold my pants.
Right. Exactly.
Scenario.
Exactly.
So you need that. And then you also need network level virus scanning. You also need, blocking the right ports. You also need, it's an arms race.
Yep.
But things that we can do, making sure that traffic that we're sending is over SSL, mm-hmm. Right. Kind of a bare minimum. You kind of need to do that.
Yep.
Don't trust data that's from an unsecured location, because if that data is coming from an unsecured location, it could set your printer on fire.
Yep.
Don't trust things that are not on your system that you don't have direct control over. When you're storing data, you need to think about, data at its origin, data in transit, and data at rest. Mm-hmm. Are each one of those locations secure? When you're storing the data, what is and is not important, it needs to be secured and so on and so forth. And then you need to take a step back from that and go, all right, what are the things that people could imply, without having direct access to my data? Mm-hmm. So one of them, there was a security company. They do home security systems. They've got a motion detector and when they sense motion, they start sending data to the server, and then they analyze it and say, is this good motion or bad motion? And then they send it back to you and say, well, there's somebody in your house that's not supposed to be there, or there's, or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that there is motion or is not motion, that means traffic on the wire.
Right.
And so if there's not traffic on the wire.
If you're just watching, on or off. Yep.
And so, so we've talked about threat modeling and all right, well, what does that mean in that scenario? And in that scenario, it means that they need to be sending a relatively consistent amount of data, regardless of whether or not it's meaningful data or not. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's just so many little things, what if their device gets hacked? Well, okay, that's bad. Mm-hmm. So anyways, when you start talking about security, yes, please.
I'll take two of those.
Please.
Yeah. Yes, please. Okay, cool. Well, we could probably spend, a week talking about this topic. I'm confident we could. So what we might have to do is have some follow-up episodes and figure out how to continue to talk about this topic. Cause I think it's really exciting and it's got so many people interested in it right now. Is there anything else that you wanted to cover before we move on?
No, I think it'd be great. I have a lot of ideas for some follow-up shows.
Yeah.
I mean, what would be interesting, I think, would be potentially to dive into a couple of different scenarios.
Okay.
And actually go, really deep with, the people who are, developing some of these scenarios and talk it through. One that might be interesting would be the kids that did the AirPi. It's a group of high school kids out of London, mm-hmm. that you're doing air quality control sensors,
right.
Built based on the Raspberry Pi. Why do they do it? How do they do it? Et cetera. And then another, there's another follow-up episode that could be, I don't know. I'm not sure how much appeal it would have, but I have learned a tremendous amount in the last year about processors, about what kind of processors are out there. There's hundreds of them. What kind of embedded operating systems are out there, what the capabilities of those embedded operating systems are.
Yep.
That alone could make another, two or three or four episodes.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, anytime we're talking about developers and physical objects in the real world, developers tend to get excited. So very cool stuff.
Absolutely.
So let's move on to the Azure pick of the week, and I'll keep this short and sweet because I know that we're pretty long right now. But my pick of the week is Azure Backup, and I just tried this out a few days ago, and now it's available. I think recently it was announced that it's available for Windows client operating systems. This is pretty cool because what you end up doing is you download this little client, and it's sort of like the Windows Backup client. It's really easy to use. It ends up giving you an automated way to do backups so you can schedule them with a really sophisticated scheduler, and it will compress and encrypt files that go over the wire that get backed up in the cloud. So it's really cool. The first 5 gigabytes is free, and then I think it's 20 cents a gigabyte after that. But it's kind of a neat backup option. I know I've used things like OneDrive as a backup before, which isn't really that great. That needs to be part of kind of a bigger backup strategy. And I would say this is the same way, but this is great for offsite backups. And it really just makes it so that you don't even have to think about it. You go in there. It's, like I said, secure. It's fast, and it just works. So I thought it was pretty amazing, and I hadn't really looked at it from the consumer perspective before, but this does also work for like servers and things like that. So I would recommend taking a look at this because it's just so darn easy. And then Carl, what do you have for the app of the week?
This week's app of the week is kind of in honor of Christmas and the holidays, not necessarily an app for you, but this is definitely an app for your children or any other child that you may know. It's a game called Terraria. And if any of your children are into Minecraft, this has a look and feel that's very similar to it. It's very blocky. It does have mining and some of that stuff. But one of the things that Minecraft kind of, you know, doesn't have is like an active combat part of the game. And this adds that in. And all of
that's what my kids are missing. Now, my kids love this game, by the way. They got this through Steam.
Yeah, and they play it nonstop. So it's on Windows Phone, iOS, Android, Steam, Xbox, PlayStation, just about anywhere. So download it, check it out.
Yeah, this actually looks kind of fun. I might have to check it out. Okay, and then we play this little game, Josh. So you probably haven't heard this game, right?
I don't think I have.
Okay. So what? It's really easy. All I need you to do is pick a number between 1 and 4, and then I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
3. Okay. Here's your question. Would you rather be at a baseball game and try to catch a foul ball with a soup can, or try and catch a foul ball with a shirt sleeve?
Shirt sleeve.
Okay. Carl, what's your number?
4.
4. Okay. Would you rather have to wear a Superman cape to school for a whole year? This is a game for kids. So let's pretend like you're back in school. So would you rather wear a Superman cape to school for a whole year, or have to wear your pajamas with the feet sewn in them every time you go out to play for a whole year? It's worded really weird.
So would I rather have
Every time you go out to play for the next year, the feet are sewn in them.
So
I don't know why they say that. It must be like footy pajamas.
Yeah, either footy pajamas or a superhero cape.
Right.
I actually wouldn't mind both. I mean,
Carl's going to take both options.
Footy jammers with the superhero cape. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, because people think you're weird if you only have one. But if you have both, they're like, oh, well, yeah.
Yeah, that's just Carl.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, so where can people find you, Josh?
So people can find me on the internet at joshholmes.com.
Okay.
Or Josh Holmes on Twitter.
Okay.
Or Josh Holmes on Flickr. Or
I'm sensing a theme.
a little bit.
Okay.
And then you can find me physically in Redmond some of the time when I'm not on a plane or in a hotel somewhere. And if you ever do get up here to the Redmond area, drop me a line. I'd love to go mountain biking or grab a beer or something like that.
Okay. But not at the same time.
Well, you know, sometimes.
Okay. Sounds good. And then Carl, where can people find you?
You can find me at WPDevGuy.com or on Twitter at Carl Schweitzer.
And you can find me at ytechie.com or on Twitter at twitter.com/ytechie. Josh, thank you so much for coming on. This was an awesome conversation. I loved hearing about IoT.
Not a problem. We'll talk to you soon.
Be sure to subscribe by searching for MS Dev Show in your favorite podcasting app. Leave us a review at iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast aggregator of choice. Visit us at msdevshow.com where you can leave comments, check out our links, show notes, and more. Visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/msdevshow. You can send us your comments and feedback directly to feedback@msdevshow.com.